The Disney Brit Podcast is sponsored by Attraction Tickets Direct and Complete Orlando. At Attraction Tickets Direct, they recognise that people nowadays want to be free from package holiday restrictions and to avoid paying prices inflated by travel agent commission. Because they don't sell through travel agents, they are able to offer attraction tickets at unbeatable prices and offer expert advice. Furthermore, the service they provide is second to none since their lines are open 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 7 days a week. Customers receive their tickets within 7 days and there are no hidden extras such as credit card fees or postage surcharges. You can call them on 0800 975 0002 or visit www.attraction-tickets-direct.co.uk. Complete Orlando are here to help simplify your Orlando holiday. They specialise solely in arranging holidays to Orlando and can therefore provide you with an expert advice and knowledge on this magical destination. They have expert staff available 7 days a week and can personalise your whole itinerary using their range of hotels, private villas and apartments to suit all budgets, as well as car rental, scheduled flights, theme park tickets and travel insurance. Their whole range can be totally tailor-made to offer complete flexibility and fit your individual requirements. Call them on 0800 294 8844 or visit www.completeorlando.co.uk.
Ah, salam and good evening to you, worthy friend. Please, please, come closer.
Too close, a little too close.
This is Julie Andrews. Once upon a time, there was a magic kingdom made of hopes and childhood fantasies. A timeless place where every land was filled with wonder. A place where everyone who entered its gates would be given the gift of the young at heart. The power to wish upon a star and unlock its magic. Are you ready to wish upon a star? Then it's time to open your heart and remember, dreams come true.
Hello, welcome to episode 22 of the Disney Brit Podcast for Wednesday, the 19th of August, 2009. Well, what have we got for you this time? Well, as this show, unfortunately, has been pre-recorded, I'm currently in Walt Disney World. There isn't any news and rumours. But to start off with, we're going to bring you the answers to the 13th edition of the Disney Brit Trivia Quiz. We then have an extremely exclusive interview, an interview with a guy who really has done a huge amount for Walt Disney World, and that is Mr. Lee Cockerell, who will be joining us to talk to us about his life and his work with Disney. We're then going to bring you the second part of the audio tour of Main Street, and then we're going to bring you the end of the show with the usual bits of news information that you need to know before we bring you the next edition of the podcast. So, a slightly abbreviated edition of the Disney Brit Podcast. I hope you enjoy it as much as you do the others. So without any further ado, let's get on with this week's edition of the Disney Brit Podcast. Welcome to the answers to the 13th edition of the Disney Brit Trivia Quiz. Now, if you haven't listened to the questions yet, make sure you go back to episode 21 and have a listen. If you have, well, here come the answers to the trivia quiz. So, let's start ourselves off at question one then for this Disney Brit Trivia Quiz. Question one then for 100 points. Name the hotel that is the front of the Disneyland Park at Disneyland Paris. And the answer is the Disneyland Hotel. Now, the Disneyland Hotel has 496 rooms with 18 suites and is the entrance to the Disneyland Park. The pink Victorian-style hotel was designed by the same group of Imagineers that created Main Street USA so that it was in keeping with its theme. Imagineers collaborated with US-based architects Wimberly Allison Tong and Gu to complete the design. Question two, then, 200 points. The Haunted Mansion was the answer to the question of where would you find the following epitaph? Dear departed brother Dave, he chased a bear into a cave. And Disney have always been experts at creating great queuing experiences for guests, and the Haunted Mansion is no different. As guests queue for the ride, they pass by a graveyard that contains gravestones with humorous epitaphs. So, some are related to particular Imagineers, such as Master Gracie and Leota. They are named after Yale Gracie and Leota Toombs. Question three, then, for 300 points. There is just one moon and one golden sun, and a smile means friendship for everyone, are lines from which Disney attraction? Let me play you a clip from that song to see if that helps you.
There is just one moon and one golden sun, and a smile means friendship to everyone. Though the mountains divide and the oceans are wide, it's a small world after all.
Well, that is, of course, It's a Small World. And this ride, an opening day attraction in both Disneyland Paris and Walt Disney World, appears in every Disney resort in the world. It includes the repetitive It's a Small World theme tune that was penned by the famous writing duo, the Sherman Brothers. This song is said to be one of the most translated and performed songs in the world. Question four, then, 400 points. What is the name of the underground corridor system below the Magic Kingdom? It is, of course, known as the Utilidors. Now, the name came from a mixture of utility and corridor combined to give an idea of what these underground corridors are like. They are described as underground, but they are actually the first floor of the Magic Kingdom. When Earth was dug out for the Seven Seas Lagoon, it was placed on top of the Utilidors that had been put in place for the Magic Kingdom. Eventually, enough Earth covered each of the corridors and the Magic Kingdom could be built on top. Each of the corridors links to a specific land, as well as hosting a number of functions for the park. Below the Magic Kingdom's second floor is waste removal, electrical operations, delivery and storage warehouses, food services, costuming and other cast member services. In total, there are 28 stairways that lead down to the Utilidors. Question five, then, for 500 points. In 1995, New Tomorrowland opened with the Astro Orbiter, but what was its original name? It was the Star Jets, and the original ride had a large white-painted shuttle as its centrepiece. 24 rockets revolved around the shuttle as guests operated each individual rocket up and down. Each shuttle was attached to a 20-foot arm. With the attraction situated atop the Tomorrowland Transit Authority station, it gave a great view over the park. With the update in 1995, the Astro Orbiter went under a cosmetic rehab that also included doubling the length of the vehicle arm from 20 to 40 feet.
Hey! Sorry, folks! I'm sure to do better next time! It was my first flight, and I'm still getting used to my programming! Hey!
Question six, 600 points. What is the name of Donald's boat in Mickey's Toontown Fair? It is the SS Daisy. Now, the original boat was much smaller than the one that stands there now. The newer home of Donald opened on the 15th of April 1996, replacing what used to be the space for the Hollywood Hills Theatre. The new boat became a water play area for children that includes water fountains and water cannons. Question 7 for some 700 points. What was the original name of Disneyland Paris's Disney Village? It was Festival Disney. Now, from 1992 to 1997, the main shopping area of the Disneyland Paris Resort was known as Festival Disney. And unlike today, large pillars were constructed throughout with strings of lights hung from them. A DJ would play music throughout the day, and at night it would create a lively nightclub feel. Finally, question 8. 800 points is the hardest one. Name the company that animated the CG character Waldo in Muppet Vision 3D. And it is the Pacific Data Images. That was the name of the company, Pacific Data Images. Now, Carl Rosendahl founded Pacific Data Images in 1980 after a small loan from his father. And in 1981, PDI began working on 3D animation software. And it was this technology that interested Disney, and they worked with them from the opening of the attraction in 1991. Now, in 1995, DreamWorks Animation SKG bought a 40% share of the company, and Pacific Data Images began working with one of Disney's biggest rivals. They have since created films such as Ants and the Shrek trilogy. Well, there you go. There are the answers for this edition of the Disney Brit Trivia Quiz. How did you do? Did you get them all right? Did you get a few? Did you beat your friends? Well, please let us know, and we will make sure that we bring you the 14th edition of the Trivia Quiz on the next episode. Imagine this. You wake up every morning knowing that you work at Walt Disney World. In fact, it's better than that. Imagine you wake up every morning and you not only work at Walt Disney World, but you are the one in charge of its overall operation. Well, not only do you have 4 theme parks to run, but you also have 20 resorts, 2 water parks, a shopping and entertainment village, a sports and recreation complex, ancillary operations, and over 40,000 cast members. If that is you, you are the senior operating executive for the Walt Disney Company. And we are pleased to welcome to the show a man who not only did this job for 9 years, but did it unbelievably well. So please welcome to the show the one and only Mr. Lee Cockrell. Hello, Lee.
Hi, thank you very much. That was impressive.
So I think Judge is going to start off with the first question.
Could I just say I'm incredibly honoured to ask the first question? And just to add, as a beforehand, that before I spoke to you, Lee, I have washed my hands to the song of Happy Birthday to You, following your recent blog.
I'm trying to keep everybody alive.
Well, it proves that I've read it and send people across to actually read it off there. First of all, I thought, why don't you tell all of us about a little bit about yourself, Lee Cockrell? What makes you?
Well, you know, I don't know whether I got lucky in my career or worked hard, but I started out at after I grew up in Oklahoma. I was never outside of Oklahoma until I was 20 years old. I grew up on a little farm, and we were poor as church mice. And I went off to the Army after I dropped out of college because my mother wouldn't pay anymore since my grades weren't good enough. And when I got out of the Army, I started at the Washington Hilton up in Washington, D.C. That's where President Reagan was shot, actually. But I started there as a banquet waiter, and lucky enough, I got into a management training program and had a good career with Hilton for about 8 years. And then I joined Marriott Corporation and stayed with them for 17 years, became vice president of food and beverage. And then in 1990, I joined Disney and went to France and opened Euro Disney, Disneyland Paris, it's called now. And in 1993, I was promoted to come back to Walt Disney World and be in charge of the hotels. And then a couple years after that, I became in charge of all the operations at Walt Disney World. So 40 years flew by quick.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
Okay.
About me, I have one wife for 40 years, actually 41 years coming up. My son, one son, Daniel, who's the vice president of Epcot now. My son told me when he was 14 he would never do what I do for a living. So much for saying what you won't do in life. And his wife also says she would never marry an American. So there's a lot of things we say we won't do.
But what a thing to end up at with Epcot and Disney, though. Okay, over to Craig.
Okay, hello, Lee.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, you're obviously a very modest person, Lee, because going through your intro there, not only were you the senior operating executive, you've had many other titles, and I know that you worked at the Washington Hilton in 1964, but you were personally appointed by President Bush in 2005, and you didn't mention that. Can you kind of tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it was Governor Bush, Jeb Bush of Florida, wanted me to be in charge of the Commission for Public Service and Volunteerism in Florida, and there was a need to get that organization more organized because of all the hurricane work and getting up offices set up all over the state and getting in better situation in case we had more catastrophes, which we have, from big fires to hurricanes to. So I enjoyed doing that, and it was just, you know, it's again using your management leadership talents to try to get people organized. And it's harder when you do it for a nonprofit because you really don't have any real authority. You just have to hopefully inspire the people and get them to follow you. And so that was good practice on being a better leader also. So that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. Met a lot of nice people.
And now you find yourself here. We're at this point now where you spent all your time with the Disney Company and you've written this book, this fantastic book called Creating Magic, 10 Common Sense Leadership Strategies for a Life at Disney. I'm desperate to get hold of my copy. I've not got it yet because it's not quite available in the UK. I know Craig got a copy when he was last over in the US. I know, Craig, what are your thoughts on the book?
You know, when I got this book, I was just saying before we went on air that I was really, really inspired by this book. I've read quite a few management books in my time, and I've kind of leant towards some of the Disney ones with the Disney Way and so on. And, you know, I followed the Stephen Covey's principles as well. But I read this book, and what I liked about this was not only was it kind of a management book that I tend to use every day, I've got lots of post-it notes in my copy that's in front of me now, but it's also kind of autobiographical because it tells us a bit about you, Lee, and what you've done and your personal experiences. So, I mean, it's a book I really do enjoy. And what also I liked about it is, you know, when I got this, I emailed you a couple of questions, Lee, and you kindly replied to me. And I had a couple of situations that I was trying to relate to your book in my work. And you kind of just replied to those as well. So, you know, to me, it's kind of like a living book. I know that I can ask the author a question, and it's something I use every day. So I think it's a great book. And, you know, I know you want to get hold of it, Adam, but you're not getting my copy. You can buy your own when they come out, because I'm not letting it off my desk.
I think it's coming out in July in the UK.
Oh, we're definitely getting hold of my copy.
The publisher in the UK published it for the territories like India and Australia and New Zealand. It went out about 6 months ago. But they'll be publishing it in the UK very shortly. And I think you're right about this book. It's very common sense. Anybody can relate to it. I hear from every industry, from hospitals to law firms to engineers to churches and ministers. I mean, it's unbelievable. I was really surprised that people say, you know, it really applies in just about any kind of work you're doing.
Lee, this book, obviously Craig's just mentioned about this management book, and there's listeners who are probably saying, well, I don't want to read a management book. Why would I want to do that? But can you tell us a little bit more about the book itself, you know, its contents, and what really made you come to think about writing it all down?
Well, I had been writing for years. I wrote a newsletter for Disney cast members for about 9 years, about 20 pages long. Every Friday it went out, and I talked about leadership. I talked about management. I talked about being more inclusive. I gave them hints on how to be better at service and how to work together. And so I had a lot of material, and I always wanted to write a book, and I always didn't think, you know, maybe nobody will buy it. No, what do I have to say? And finally, a lady in New York who's a literary agent convinced me that I should write this book. And so I, when I retired, I started writing it, got the okay from Disney and did a contract with Disney to allow me to write the book, and using a lot of Disney material, and went to work and wrote it. Took about 2 years from start to finish. It's now in 10 languages around the world. Chinese came out last week. Korea and Indonesia are coming out shortly, and then all 10 languages will be out there. We're working on a few others, but I just came back from Brazil, where I went down to do a book tour last week, and it's doing well there. And I may start doing some consulting in Brazil. It's a very hot market, and the economy is good down there. So it's just opened a lot of opportunities for me. And the book, you know, it just, I started, I think the first strategy, you know, was the most important one. I said, remember, everyone's important. And that's one thing I've always thought in my whole career. You know, I started at the bottom. I started in an hourly job. I worked my way up, so I understood those jobs. And I think people need to not forget that it takes all of us to get the job done, and not to forget that everyone's important, and treat them that way, and to show respect and inclusiveness, and to be able to be available for your people and listen. You know, it's like when I answer everybody that writes to me. Sometimes people say, when they write to me, they'll say, well, I know you probably don't have time to answer me. Of course you have time. It doesn't take that long. And when people say they don't have time, I don't buy that, because I answer lots of people every single day, because I just don't want to. I can't imagine how somebody would feel if you just blew them off and didn't write them back. And because most people are writing and want some advice, or they would like some help, or they would like to, something like that. So the book is full of real-life strategies. At the end of every chapter, there's a little checklist that tells you to think about these things harder. If you start to implement them in your career and in your life, you'll probably end up with a better life, a better job, and a better career, and better results. And they're tested, and they've worked, and we've worked, tried them at the... This is how we worked at Disney World, and a lot of that is in addition to what I learned when I worked for Hilton and Marriott through the years. So there's 40 years of advice there that maybe some young people can not make some of the mistakes I made in my early career before I learned some of these things.
I think from a purely selfish point of view, from myself and Adam, we both work in the public sector in the UK. I work in a hospital and Adam works in a school. And I notice a lot of your, you know, looking through your blog, it's very much like, make sure you get yourself sorted before you start trying to change other people. Would this book be something that can translate into both mine and Adam's field of work throughout it, you know, the hospital and the schools type of thing?
Absolutely. And I'm working with a lot of public schools in the U.S. now to get this to the kids in school early on when they're in 9th and 10th grade and 11th grade, to get them to start thinking about not doing something stupid and ruining their reputation, and understanding they already have a reputation, and that they can be leaders. I gave a speech to one group, and a girl came up to me afterwards, and she said, Mr. Cockrell, thank you for coming today. Until today, I did not know I could be a leader until you told me I could be. Wow, you know, that's pretty sad that her parents weren't encouraging her, or the schools, or the teachers. And these kids, if they don't have good self-esteem and self-confidence, they're not going to know that they can do this too. And that's really what makes me like to give the speeches and to go talk to kids and to try to build up their confidence so that they go out in the world and try to do something, because many of them have the ability and they can do it. And so that's the big payoff when somebody comes up and says something to you like that, that you help change their way they think, or to change their life. Or when you get a letter 10 years later where somebody says, you know, the way you helped me really got me where I am today. And I get those too. And I'm really proud of that. So it's fun.
I think that's a really excellent point, you know, that from me working in a school point of view, there's a lot of kids who don't understand the idea of leadership. And I'm lucky in the school that I work at, where leadership is one thing that's really pushed quite a lot with a lot of initiatives we do. And I think your book's exactly right, that, you know, if we don't teach people about leadership properly and early enough, then it doesn't necessarily, you know, relate to children and relate as they grow up.
Well, I agree. In that first chapter, remember, everyone's important. You know, kids can be very mean when they're young. Girls can be mean and make other girls feel badly and exclude people and have these little quirky things going on. And you need to teach them not to go around hurting people. And, you know, there's a lot of bullies in schools and a lot of people that are misbehaving. And I guarantee you, my grandkids are not doing it, because we don't stand for that at our house and at their house. And it's, you know, it's all about teaching them early and catching them early before
Excellent.
They just ruin their lives.
Excellent.
So I think it can be anywhere. And I think the government issues are probably harder, because we get a change of administration every so many years and somebody comes in with a new plan. But I think you can make a difference. And you got to start by making a difference. Make sure the people who report to you, that you're being a good leader for them. That's the starting place.
Now, your book, Lee, it seems quite heavily focused on the US labour market. Now, with the sort of multinational and therefore multicultural companies become more widespread now, do you think that your lesson will work? You know, for instance, Craig's company that he works for is owned by one of India's largest corporates, and therefore their cultural way of interacting and working is very different. Have you sort of experienced that, and how did it, if at all, did it change your views?
Well, the book's selling really well in India, by the way.
I don't think some of my bosses have read it yet, Lee.
Whether they implement it or not, you know, nobody changes until they have to. Look at what's going on in Iran right now. The young people are resisting. And it's just a matter of time. If you don't treat people right, you're going to have violence, or you're going to have people pushing back or quitting. And India's economy is going to grow well, and they can only do this for so long. It's like the U.S. We used to treat our people the same way, but then all of a sudden, now we need an educated workforce. You start treating educated people badly, they just quit because there's not enough of them anyway to fill all the jobs. And if you don't keep good, smart people in your company, you're not going to make it. And so I think everybody will do what they're doing until they have to change. And some people are going to be smart enough to change before they have to. And I guarantee you, this whole thing in Iran right now is being caused by young people fed up with it. And they're highly educated in Iran, too, much more than a lot of parts of the Middle East. And you see that in many countries. It's always the young people who change things. And so the old people can either change them or have a riot on their hands eventually. And sometimes a riot is just losing your people and people quitting and going to other companies or not being committed when they're at work. They just come in, get their paycheck. They don't really care. So got to be smart enough and have the vision to treat people right, and then you'll even get better results.
Okay. Yep.
I mean, I say that all the time. If you treat me well, I treat you well. You don't treat me well, I treat you well. You know? It's just the way it is. The better you treat me, the better I treat you.
Lee, your career, you've had many tough challenges, and I mean, you do talk about some in the book, which obviously I've read, but the others haven't, and our listeners probably wouldn't have done. I mean, you've had hurricanes and the 9/11 and so on, but the park's only closing or being closed once before these events. How did you kind of coordinate everything, and how did the Disney cast members help?
Yeah, well, I'm the one that closed it all of the time, including the first time, because that hurricane had almost came to Florida. I decided to close it because I was just afraid it did not come ashore. It turned and went north, but it couldn't take people's lives, and I mean, we couldn't take a chance. But the cast members during the hurricanes were incredible. 5,000 of them each time volunteered to stay on the property, and they didn't have to do this. They left their own homes, came in, stayed on the property so that the minute the wind was gone and the hurricane passed, they could get out there and get the place ready. And we opened the next day every time. And we could have never done that without a cast member. And they did that because they wanted to, not because they had to. They didn't have to. They wanted to. Yeah. And that's what happens. You treat people right when they're proud of being part of and they feel like they have a responsibility. And that's the kind of stuff you get when you treat people properly and show respect to them and make sure they understand they're part of the big picture.
Because I think what was interesting to me, Lee, in your book, that you mentioned about your insurance company, the head of your insurance company who was insuring Disney at the time was staying on property, wasn't he? I mean, could you perhaps just explain kind of that story to everybody? Because that was very interesting.
Yeah, well, the head of the insurance company was staying at the Yacht and Beach, and he saw all this work going on and getting ready for the hurricane. And he said he was very impressed at it. And he stopped one person and asked him, what they were doing, they were putting sandbags in front of the doors, and it turned out to be the general manager of the hotel. Everybody was working on it. And he said the fans were being tied down, everything was being saved. And he said he went back to his room, and he saw that, he said, well, Disney forgot one thing. They forgot to bring the furniture in from my balcony. And when he went to dinner, he came back, that furniture was in his room. They had remembered that. And they put a note on it that we'll put this furniture back on the balcony as soon as the hurricane leaves. He said that blew his mind. And we didn't even hit the deductible for our insurance. We had very little damage because everybody was doing what they were trained to do, and we learned how to do that in advance. We practiced every year what to do, what every single person does. So everything was put away. In May, we start cleaning up the property so there'll be no debris around, nothing flying around in the wind. We get totally ready, and it saved millions and millions and millions of dollars because we had a committed, proud cast members, and then they showed up and did the work. And that's just, you know, it's a kind of common sense. If you treat people well, they feel a part of the organization and they want to help. And if you treat them badly, I wonder how many General Motors people would show up and help out.
Not many now.
No. Or Chrysler, or God knows. And I'm sure there's many companies in the UK where the people don't feel like they're respected and they wouldn't come in and help.
Yeah, exactly. I think what you've mentioned there is the fact that, you know, what the cast members made of Disney World, etc. For yourself, you know, what ranks as the sort of the memorable moments for you, whether it's, you know, whether it's very big things or just silly little small things?
Well, the big thing certainly was 9/11. I was sitting in my office when my wife called me here. She just heard on the radio that a plane had gone into the World Trade Center. And, well, we just thought it was a little nothing, you know, a little plane crashed. And I went over to talk to my boss, and we watched it on TV. And then that was a day I'll never forget. Actually, it was many, many weeks I'll never forget because we didn't take a day off for the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And we immediately closed the parks. We had a we have a command center. We can open in 30 minutes. We got everybody, all the guests out of the parks in about 90 minutes and back to their hotel because we didn't know what else had happened, Disney or anywhere else, in Las Vegas, New York, you know, anything could have been going on because we just didn't know what was happening. So that was probably the proudest time. And I think when the company stepped up and gave guests who were staying there free rooms, they didn't charge them for phone calls because they couldn't get out. They couldn't get airline flights. It was a very proud time to see. I told people that's when leadership pays off, when you see everybody. The cast members stayed cool and calm, and that was important to evacuate the parks with everybody being calm and not being excited and not scaring the guests. Not having somebody injured, and all the buses showed up and took everybody back. It worked like a charm. It was unbelievable. You practice, but when you do the real thing, that's when you go, wow. It takes a lot of people to do that coordinated. So that was a great time, and certainly hurricanes, too. I think I'm always proud when our people step up during a crisis. It's easy to, you know, when everything's fine, the sun's shining, and it's nice, cool weather, and it's not raining, everything's easy. It's when things go bad or when we have an accident and everybody pulls together and helps the family or helps the fellow cast members. Those are things you remember more than the good days because the good days just go well and there's not much stress. So,
yeah. But it proved it works, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing, let's go back a few years, Nellie. Another thing you were instrumental in setting up was the Main Street Diary back in, I think, was it 2000? What was the reasons for doing that?
I always wanted to write a leadership document because I wanted to help people learn. And even with my book, people will tell me, you know, I get people writing back to me and they'll say, you know, I never thought about it that way. This has really helped me be a better manager. I've tried this in my business, and I'm getting better results. And so I just started writing, and I started publishing. I had a lady, Terry Shar, at Disney, who helped me. She was kind of the editor. She checked everything, made it was spelled right. It was all set up properly, and we set it up for you. I went in every morning at 6 o'clock and wrote. So we published it every Friday at 5 o'clock, and all the cast members at Disney got it. And then a lot of people outside of Disney started getting it because they wanted it. And I got people from Air Force generals to college presidents using it. It's unbelievable. And so it just started to be good, common sense advice for people on how to be a better leader, a better manager, improve service, how to have more diversity in your company. It just took off. So that's why, I enjoyed doing it because half the battle is communicating properly. Somebody said, you know, if you'll just be clear, you'll get a lot better results. Be clear with your people and then make sure you enforce your policies. Be clear. Clarity is a big deal. And so many companies today, people will tell you they don't have any idea what's going on. Nobody ever talks to them. Nobody tells them anything. So this was another way I could talk directly to the cast. And it went out on email and it went out in hard copies. And if people didn't read it, it was their own fault. They didn't know what was going on. So we communicated much better having a document where every single Friday it went out at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, you know, something that I miss actually in my present company, I work in the legal field, and in my law firms that I've worked in before, we've always had a Friday newsletter. And since I moved out of law firms into commerce, we just don't have that sort of communication, and it's kind of missed. So I can really see the benefit for that.
Well, it was a great way to thank the cast members, too, to say thank you for what you did last week, or to thank an individual cast member for saving a guest's life, or, you know, recognition and appreciation are so important, and that was another way to publicly do it. Everybody likes to get their name in the newspaper. In a positive way. So that was just another great source. People, and then it was a way to teach. We would put in their letters from guests telling us what a great job we did and why they loved us. All the cast members would read that. Then they would see what you have to do to please a guest or how you take care of a problem. So it was a great tool to educate also and to train and to teach.
And I think Terry is still the editor, isn't she, of the Main Street Diary?
What's that?
I think, is Terry still the editor of the Main Street Diary?
The Main Street Diary is still being written. It goes out every week. Aaron Wallace, who replaced me, continued it. So it's still going out. I read it every week.
Okay. And
Okay. Sorry, Adam. No, I was just going to test Lee. I was going to test Lee to see whether if he probably doesn't remember because he reads it every week. But I don't know if you remember a story of a very cute little boy with blonde hair in the Main Street Diary who had lost his pin Leonard in Animal Kingdom from the UK, and the cast members replaced it for him. There was a photograph of him very happy having received his new one because that was my son.
That exactly. That would be a common story that would be in there to show how a little thing, like, I'm sure he replacing that was probably, you know, for children. They get very upset if they lose something special, and the cast is really good about things like that. And I would say, again, there's not many companies where that would happen.
No, he was overjoyed. Yeah, definitely.
And we get a lot of UK visitors, so we try to make them happy because we need them to come back.
There's no problem with that there, I don't think. But Lee, you set up the Main Street Diary. You worked for Disney World for all of these years. And of course, for somebody who's given that much dedication for so long in their life, it's only right that Disney honoured them in some way. And of course, Disney honoured you with one of the most prestigious events, I think, that they hold. And that's on September the 26th, 2006. You were given your very own Main Street window, which I think reads, the Main Street Diary, Time Tales of Inspiration. Lee A. Cockerell, Editor-in-Chief. What was the experience like of receiving that?
Oh, man, I about fainted. Because that's supposed to be with the company at least 25 years to get that, and I was only there 16, and they still awarded me my own window above, right on Main Street above the Uptown Jewelers. So I was very proud of that. My grandkids and my wife and my mother-in-law, we all went there for the ceremony, and they were quite proud of me. And it's nice. If people, I get emails every week where people say, we saw your window and just wanted to tell you it looks great and we're glad we saw it, or the cast members tell us to go look at it. And it's pretty cool to know that window is always going to be there. And it was a nice recognition, and I really appreciated it.
Cool. If I can bring you back to our neck of the woods, Europe, of which you were heavily involved in between 91 and 93 as the VP of the resort of Euro Disney, what sort of experiences can you say when you came across here that you had working in Euro Disney? Because it was quite a culture change for Europe to have Disney come across to Paris, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big deal. And I tell you, the hardest part, as I look back on it, number one, having to hire people that spoke so many languages. So we had to hire, you know, we staffed our front desk of the hotel with trying to make sure we had every language on the front desk. So when people checked in from Italy or Spain or the UK or France, that somebody could speak their language. And that was pretty challenging. And then hiring all new managers. Nobody had ever worked for Disney before, so there was no culture.
No.
When you don't have a culture, it's tough. To start, because the people don't really understand. A culture takes a long, long time, and people don't even understand it. But when you're in a culture, you understand it. And this was quite a challenge to get everybody to think about really making every guest feel special and treating all the guests as individuals. And I think the frontline feeling of responsibility for the service. That's something that happens at Disney World and Disneyland, but it's not so common in Europe. For the frontline people to feel like they are really responsible.
I mean, Lee, how
for their manager to be responsible, and we want everybody at Disney to feel responsible. So that was pretty challenging.
I mean, how difficult was it for you with the French recruiting French personnel to act and probably to work in a way that might be slightly alien to them? I mean, was that a big challenge for you?
Yeah, it was, and I mean, and not only that, the management we hired had never worked for Disney either. So it was hard for them to kind of set the right example always, because they hadn't worked at Disney either. But I would say every nationality was a challenge. We hired a lot of Irish kids, a lot of kids from UK, a lot of people from the Netherlands, Germany, all over. And not only French, but if you just don't understand a product, it's harder. And none of those people, really hardly any of those young people, had been to Disney World. And so it was frustrating, and it was tough. And we just kept chipping away at it, trying to do the best we can. And I think today it's about, 50% of the visitors are from France now, when in the beginning that wasn't true. We started out pretty rough and just started making some money last year.
Yes.
But it was a rough project.
And you say Disney's obviously was quite new to Paris and to Europe, really. And those leadership and management styles of the leadership and management team you brought in were brand new to Disney. How did the Disneyland Paris management leadership style differ to that of Walt Disney World? Was there a huge culture difference? Was it something that you had to tweak? Or, you know, was it like throwing it all out and starting again?
I would say that once we got there and got the managers trained, we sent all of them to Disney World for a few weeks to just get a taste of it. And by the way, I'd never worked for Disney either. Mm-hmm. Although I came from Marriott, which is very similar to Disney. We really, if you think about Marriott hotels, they've got a good reputation. The frontline people are really cool. They're friendly, keep the places clean, do a good job. So it wasn't hard for me to understand the culture. I was only at Disney World 6 weeks before I went to France. And had really never even visited Disney before in Florida. So I didn't tell them that during the interview. Thought they might not hire me. But it was difficult. It was hard. And but the manager, slowly but surely, I think we treated all of the cast members very respectfully at Euro Disney. I think if you would talk to anybody that was in the opening there, they saw quite a difference from where they had worked before in the world. The way we trained them, the way we talked to them, the way we asked their opinion. But it's still, you can't do it in just a few weeks. It takes time. And a lot of people don't trust management. They don't trust leadership anyway. And I think that's true maybe in Europe a lot, too, just like it is in the U.S. The leaders are always making mistakes. They're being corrupt. National leaders are not setting a good example. Business leaders are not setting a good example. So a lot of people on the front lines and lower down in management don't trust leadership. That's part of the problem. You know, when you think about it, we all complain about our government leadership, our school leadership, business leadership, all the bad things that are going on with the banks and the real estate market. And those are all leadership issues of where leaders let us fail. So it's hard to get people to trust leadership, and you've got to just keep plugging away at it.
Yeah, yeah. Since you left your Disney as it was then, have you actually managed to get yourself back to Disneyland Paris at all since you've left there?
Oh yeah, I've been back a few times.
What's your impression of it now from when you left it? Because you tend to find you sometimes can cast a critical eye on something that you left and you go, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way.
Well, it was a whole lot more fun visiting than having to manage it. So I had a pretty good time, actually. I stayed there a couple of times. I did some seminars, went back and talked to the management. It was good. It was fun. You know, when I was there, you were such turmoil, and we were losing so much money that it wasn't very enjoyable for me at the time, just trying to get the place managed properly. So going back as a guest was, you know, of course, a lot better and different. You see it differently when you're a guest than you do when you're trying to get it straightened out and keep from losing $1 million a day. So it's good. And they're working hard at it.
Their
attendance is way up now. They're up there about 14 million. Yeah. They're probably down with this economy we're in now, but they're getting better and better.
Definitely.
I think following on from Jazz, I was probably just going to add, you know, when you're visiting the resorts, Lee, are you looking at kind of it as a guest now? You can go back and relax and enjoy it. Or are you looking and seeing what's kind of been happened and what's embedded into the company over the 16 years you were there and thinking about the ways that it's changed? I mean, is that still going through your head, or can you now just go and relax with your family and you say with your grandchildren, enjoy it?
I get over things pretty easily. And you know, because a lot of things got changed right after I left, because we went back and put more French food in, all that work we did didn't really work very well, so we had to take it out. You really can't take it personally, or else you'll have a heart attack. So I've learned that there's business and there's personal life. You know, my wife got very sick this last year, and I got really ended up in a tough situation. She was in the hospital 51 days, and she almost died.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And, yeah, and she's getting better now, but she's got to have one more surgery. Well, what happened during the 51 days? I was in the hospital trying to manage the nurses and doctors and get her home and get her safe. She was in four times. I ended up with depression.
Wow.
So I had to go see a psychiatrist, get medication. And so I told the doctor, I said, why did I get this? I said, I've been under stress my whole career. He said, Lee, the difference between business stress and personal stress is totally different.
Mm. Yeah.
I thought your wife was going to die. You know, business is business, but personal is your family, your kids, and that affects you totally differently. And there's a chemical change that takes place in your brain. And they put me on medication, and it took about 4 months before I got over it.
Wow.
But it just, you know, you think you can take a lot of pressure until it hits you home, at your home, or something happens to your parents, or something happens to your wife or girlfriend or children. And so it was a good lesson that you're not as tough as you think you are sometimes.
And you're talking about family. Sorry, carry on.
What's that?
You were talking about family, and of course, now you've stepped down from the Walt Disney Company. Your son Dan is now following in your footsteps and is now currently the VP of Epcot. You know, that must make you extremely proud.
That was a proud day when he called us to tell us that. It happened on his birthday, February 18th, and he called to tell us about it. I just told him, I'm just glad you have a job in this economy. I didn't want to sit back in my house. So, but we're really proud of him, and he's done great. And he's been with Disney almost 20 years.
Because from what I understand, he was working before you were, wasn't he? Didn't he join the company when he was at the college program?
I did, yeah. He worked on the college program. And he started in 91, so in, let's see, we've got a couple of years, he'll be with the company 20 years. And,
wow.
He's already been with the company longer than I was with the company. So he's... he's good. He got his new job on his 40th birthday. So
excellent. Excellent news.
I think you're probably going to tell me off now, because I think I'm going to go. But working in the NHS, what happens is I tend to work for different hospitals, but you're still within the NHS side of it. And I do have a nasty habit of sometimes looking back on somewhere where I've left and going, why are they doing that? Or why have they changed things, which you're probably saying I shouldn't do. But is there times at Disney you felt, you know, oh, that's a really positive change since you've left? Or why on earth have you just gone and done that? Because I would have done it differently. Or do you see a separation like you're saying?
Things are always changing. They're always thinking of new ideas. I just heard one the other night where now employees, we don't tell them when they work. They tell us when they can work. And that's the schedule they have. So they say I can work Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and that's their schedule. Because we used to have a lot of people quit because they were going to school or they couldn't work certain days or their wife, they need to stay home with the kids. Now we reversed it. They tell us what days they can work, and that's how they're scheduled.
I like that idea. How much
and
if
you
work?
Can work, if you can work seven, if you can work 7 days a week, then you just tell them you're available, and then you might get overtime. And what ends up happening, we're able to fill all the shifts. People are happy. They get to be with their children or when they have to be, or a graduation or going to something. And you think there's a real dynamic change of thinking. Who would ever think you could do it the opposite way? And that's probably the better way. If you're making the cast happy, instead of forcing a schedule down their throat that they don't like and they end up quitting.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Like,
they're always coming up with Friday. I said, why didn't I think of that? Somebody did about it. And, you know,
that could be version two of the book.
IT systems today can do that. So it's, with technology, a lot of changes are going to happen and more interaction. The guests want to be more involved in the attractions and the rides. And so it'll always be changing. So that's great, and it should, because Disney guests expect it to be changing all the time.
Well, Lee, let me ask you a question about being a Disney guest. When you go to all of the parks, and you've probably been to all of them worldwide, I would have thought, with your travels, you know, what's your favorite ride or attraction worldwide?
You know, I'll tell you, my favorite might have been Rock and Roller Coaster. But what happened is, as my grandchildren were little and as they grew up, it's funny how you really like the ones they love. So I spent a lot of time in Fantasyland until they got older. right? Or to see the excitement of my grandson when he could drive those little cars over in Fantasyland. You know, I think it's more exciting what they like than what you like, because to them, this is just, my grandkids are in Oklahoma right now, seeing my brother and seeing where I grew up. They're having so much fun because they're getting to shoot fireworks every night, and they're getting to drive a golf cart down to the store by themselves, you know, and they're thinking this is heaven. And I saw that when I take them, and they wanted to do a Buzz Lightyear. My grandson, he wanted to go on it over and over and over again, see if he could beat me in the score, you know. And that's where you get the excitement. But I like my wife didn't love Rock and Roller Car. I just like the thrill of that takeoff, just an amazing takeoff, or Tower of Terror, seeing everybody screaming and very nervous when they got on it. And so, yeah, and some of the shows, you know, the shows are just fabulous. The Broadway kind of shows they do at Disney. And so there's so many different things to like. But I would say Epcot was one of my favorites. I'm glad my son ended up there, because we like to go there in the afternoon late and walk around, see things, and then have dinner in one of the restaurants and meet the cast that are from either the UK or Italy or Japan. Or it's just a very interesting. I think it's one of the most diverse places in the world, probably, Epcot. People are from everywhere, living, working there. And
that sort of answers my next question. I was going to ask you, you know, what's your favorite Disney park worldwide? Is it Epcot, or is there another one somewhere else in the world that you prefer?
Yeah, I would say probably Epcot, because I like the cultures. I like seeing the people and having the kind of the front of the park, which got more rides over the years, and then the back of the park, which is all about the culture and the dining and learning about the culture and seeing the movies. Our favorite movie is the one of France, I tell you, at the French Pavilion. There. I mean, I could watch that movie. And watching Illuminations fireworks at night, it's quite emotional. It's quite moving. And Doug, my grandkids would tell you Magic Kingdom. And they love that until they're about 10. Mm-hmm. And when they're after they're 10, they want to go on their scary rides. And so they move to other parks. But I think it depends how old you are and what's going on in your life, which park you're most having the most fun in. Animal Kingdom, what a fabulous place.
Hmm.
I mean, it's just incredible, that park. So it's hard to say one's always your favorite, because they really are quite special. Epcot, my wife and I, we like to get a glass of wine and have dinner. And can't do that much.
I'm with you with Epcot, there, Lee.
Yeah, I can't hardly eat without those last ones.
We're all with you on that, yeah.
But I totally agree. I think Illuminations, you know, I find it incredibly moving. You know, it's very easy to get a tear in your eye with that. With noticing that you sort of on the trustee board of the Culinary of America, what is your favorite Disney hotel worldwide, and is that related to sort of the food angle?
Well, I was very involved. My career was 25 years in food and beverage, and then I was very involved in the changes in the restaurants here. I mean, I put Dieter Hanning, our vice president of food and beverage, who became senior vice president, in his job, and he and I together just made a world of difference. And when we first opened the California Grill, which really turned the place upside down, it was a great concept, still is today. And then we just went to restaurant after restaurant, and the Flying Fish over at Boardwalk, Citrico's at the Grand Floridian, and we got all great chefs now. The food is excellent wherever you go at Walt Disney World. But I'm probably sentimental to the California Grill, because I was very involved in selling that to Michael Eisner, going out to see him and talking him into it. And so that was the one who was the foundation for changing all food and beverage at Walt Disney World, and seeing that it's really important to have great food.
Cool.
People are traveling from all over the world. People demand good food and service today.
Can I ask you a bit of a bizarre question now, Lee? I read Disney Wars a while back, and it stated there that sometimes executives, etc., got to actually have to be out and go out and be a character or be involved in the character activity at all. Were you ever dumped in a character costume and pushed out? Or?
Yeah, sure. I did it frequently. That's when you see the real fantasy in the children's eyes and the parents when they meet characters. These kids, my niece said when she was 10 years old, she said, "I know those characters aren't real except Mickey Mouse." she believed. And so
who was your character?
The kids just Yeah, I mean, they just go nuts, and it really makes you feel good.
What was,
understand
what,
how
sorry.
Hard it is to do those jobs.
What was your favorite character then, Lee? Who do you like to play the most then?
I liked Tigger. Tigger was pretty high energy and pretty jumping around all the time, and I'm pretty high energy, so I guess I kind of associated with him. Mickey couldn't have quite as much fun as Tigger could, but that was a lot of fun.
Now, Lee, to round off, our listeners will already know that here at the Disney Brit Podcast, we've started something new, something that we've entitled the Legacy Award. And this is an award that we're giving to people to recognise the service and the work that they've done for Disney, not only maybe in the Disney online community, but maybe also through working within the parks or working for Disney themselves. And this is something that, you know, it doesn't mean a huge amount outside of the Disney world, but you've obviously got the honour of a Main Street window, and it doesn't quite live up to that. But this Legacy Award, as we said, we're only going to give out to people who we really believe have used their passion for Disney. And Lee, we think that you are just such a great example of somebody who's been passionate for Disney. And actually, we would like to give you the first ever Legacy Award from the Disney Brit Podcast, sponsored by Orlando Sky Radio. But you know, I hope that you would receive this award from us, this Legacy Award, to say, you know, well, congratulations.
Honored.
Thank you for everything.
Thank you very much. That's a big surprise. I appreciate it.
We want to keep a surprise.
I think it's true. If you don't have passion, it shows. If you have passion, people can see it. They can feel it. They know, you know, the excitement. And everybody, I tell people all the time, if you're not passionate about what you're doing, find something else to do, because life's pretty boring if you're not passionate.
And you can
how many people wake up every day and just hate their jobs? It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
I can imagine that.
You can go over to www.disneybrit.com/Hall of Fame, and there you can find Lee's picture as the first recipient of the Legacy Award. And if you click on Lee's picture, you will be able to look at some more information about Lee, with links in there to books, things like that. We can tell you that according to amazon.co.uk, your book is going to be available on the 2nd of July. So, you know, get out there, get pre-ordering that one, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt.
I guess they didn't want to put it on the 4th of July. The UK is kind of sensitive.
But, Lee, in all seriousness, thank you for taking your time to come on and speak to us guys here over in the UK. You know, really is an inspiration to hear somebody who, you know, knows what they're talking about when it comes to leadership and management, and really does have that passion for it and that passion for Disney, and is able to share it with our listeners.
Well, I appreciate it. You all have a good time. Good luck with the website. That's great.
Thank you. And Lee, can you just tell us, whereabouts can we go to find out more about your book and more about yourself?
About my book?
Yeah, and yourself. Where can we go to find out some more?
Well, you can go to my website, www.leecockerel.com. And I always tell people, if you want to learn a lot about me, just Google me. You won't find one negative thing on there. I've been able to stay clean, but there's a lot of information about me and about what guests have to say and about my book. And I publish a leadership blog 3 times a week. People can sign up for it. It's free. Mm-hmm. I give advice Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on how to be a better leader, how to be a better manager, how to be better at time management, how to get better service. And people all over the world are using that to help themselves. And it's just a free site that has good Disney recommendations on how to be a better manager and leader in your life and at home and in your community and in your whole life. Because, you know, if you're going to be a leader, you got to do it 24/7. You've got to go home and set the right example for your children and for your people and for neighbors. And you can't be a leader at work and a jerk at home. It doesn't work that way. And you have a lot of influence. You know, there's no greater role model for a child than their mother and father. I mean, that is what forms them. That's what makes them who they are. And a lot of parents are not being careful about how they behave in front of their children, and they're not good role models. And shame on them, because you ruin a child's life.
Well,
so that's my thought.
Well, also, again, Lee, thanks very much for coming onto the show. I don't know whether the other guys have got something they want to say just before we round off the interview.
Definitely. I'll jump in before Jazz today. Lee, I wanted to say, actually, I mean, it's actually a great honour for me to speak with you because, as I said, you know, I have your book. I literally do have it on my desk, and lots of people come into my office and, you know, ask what it's about, and they kind of mockingly know that I'm a big Disney freak and think it's a Disney book. But I just, you know, just show them a few things and they kind of back off those ideas. And, you know, a couple of people have asked it. And, you know, hopefully my team think that I'm now better because I've read this book. So, you know, for me personally, I wanted to thank you because this is the best kind of management style book that I've read, maybe because it's focused on you and Disney and you've had such a interesting career that it sticks in my mind a bit more. But so for me and probably hopefully for my team, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd really just to reiterate what they've said, Lee. What I would like to push is make sure that everyone goes and checks your blog out. As you say, I think it's that little sort of paragraph of information that pops up, you know, several times a week that I look at. And to be honest with you, the great thing about yourself is I think, do you know what? That's common sense. Why didn't I think of that in the first place? And I think everyone should go down and just get the blog. I think there's a lot of great points popping up there that probably substantiate your book as well.
They do. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Anyway, thank you, Lee. Hello and welcome back to Disneyland Park. We are stood here on Main Street once again, and we are this time going to take you down the right hand side of Main Street. Now, if you're following this audio guide as you're in the park, then you're going to be able to be stood right in front of the Main Street Transportation Company at this point, sort of just up from the exit to the Disneyland Railroad. And here we have, of course, the Main Street Transportation Centre, the centre where most of the vehicles would have been kept. Titled is 1883. Now, the Main Street Transportation Building is the first building you pass on the right of Town Square and houses many of the transportation found travelling down Main Street. It's a red bricked building with large wooden doors, and the main transportation sign is grey with these sort of brown lettering on. The plaque, like I already said, says 1883, as it's supposed to be its year of construction. It is number 24 on Main Street, and this actually has no windows that have any sort of writing or anything on there. So sort of a small window on the left-hand side and another one on the right-hand side. But to the left of the Main Street Transportation Company is a green staircase. And this staircase, you're not able to climb, unfortunately. There's a gate in front that stops you from doing so. But it takes you upstairs to Dr. Bitts Dental School. So it's the place where Dr. Bitts has three windows. And this is above another Bixby Brothers store. And the three windows read the following: Dentist in Training, Licensed to Use Laughing Gas, J. Burke, T. Delaney, T. Morris, E. Soto and C. Tietz. Our business is making you smile. Middle window has a large open mouth. It has like, it's almost a logo bitten in between the teeth. And one of the top teeth is gold. And on the right-hand side, we have E.S. Bitts DDS, School of Dentistry. Fully licensed, 1859. 9 out of 10 patients go to Bitts. I sort of quite like that idea. Now, Dr. Bitts was a character created for the purpose of the dentist, and it's not related to Disney anyway. It's just to help get across these five names. Now, the middle window, as we said, has this drawn mouth. It doesn't have anything else on there, but the names we're looking for are the ones on the left-hand side. Now, Jay Burke is Jeff Burke. He's the Frontierland show producer, and each of these names are actually related to a producer for each of the lands. He's a Frontierland show producer, and we don't mean shows as in, you know, the things that you're able to go and see in the park. We're talking about what you can see on stage, as Disney call it. He also worked as art director of the Haunted Mansion and contributed to the Enchanted Tiki Room. He was jointly responsible for America Sings at Disneyland with the Imagineering legend Mark Davis. Tim Delaney is the Discoveryland show producer. He and other Imagineers are responsible for the look of the land. Delaney joined the Disney back in 1976 and has also worked on the Living Seas in Epcot and Disney's California Adventure. Tom Morris was the Fantasyland show producer, and he was responsible, obviously, for the creation of Fantasyland. He was also the designer of Sleeping Beauty's castle. He was Tony Baxter's assistant for the 1983 reworking of Disney's Fantasyland, so he had some sort of expertise in it already.
Eddie Sotto, Main Street show producer where we're standing. He originally wanted Main Street to be set in the 1920s, and this was the inspiration for the turn-of-the-century America idea that we got. They wanted to originally try and update Main Street here and have it as a slightly more modern version compared to what you would find in other places, right. But they decided that actually they would do it as you would find in other parks. He's also the voice of the dentist and the patient you can hear. If you listen really carefully, you can hear the sound. It was actually one of the windows at the bottom half of the one with the teeth actually missing, so you can hear the sound coming through the speakers. The last person, Chris Tietz, was the Adventureland show producer. He was instrumental in the Disneyland Paris Adventureland because he felt, along with Mark Davis, that Europeans needed a bigger, different kind of Adventureland, and this is exactly what he got. And obviously, we've talked about in the past that Adventureland has not quite been what we thought it would have been, but you know, he had a lot of ideas that didn't necessarily make it. We're moving along to Ribbons and Bows Hat Shop. And above the Ribbons and Bows Hat Shop, there is another window, and it reads the following. Pie Wacket Cruise Liners. For a day you will treasure, book a cruise that's a pleasure. Captain Roy E. Disney. Now, this window pays tribute to Walt's nephew, Roy E. Disney. And in the nautical community, Roy Disney is well known for his sailing achievements. Competing in the Trans-Pacific Yacht Race, the Transpac, he has only missed one race in 30 years, and that was in 1997 because his leg was broken from a car crash. Now, in 1999, Roy set sail in the Transpac Los Angeles to Honolulu, it is. And this time, he was on a mission. And the previous race in 1997, he had been won by his son. And his son managed to knock nearly a day off the race, which was supposed to be 8.5-day challenge. Now, amazingly, Roy this time manages to beat his son's record by over 3 hours, claiming the winning position and the trophy. So, going back to the window, you can see where the connection is between Roy and his boats. The name Pie Wacket, this is the name of his trophy-winning yacht. Now, the second window above the shop reads, Dengelman, Janier and Cannelly, efficiency experts. Thor Dengelman, Pierre Janier and David Cannelly, are you reading this fast enough? Now, Thor Dengelman was the Disney Company's Human Resources Director of Overseas Parks. He has since become CEO of Ledo International. And Pierre Janier was the Vice President of Human Resources at the time. David Cannelly was the manager of the World Showcase Fellowship Program at Walt Disney World between 1974 and 1985. He then became Director of the Disney University Euro Disney from 1989 to 1993. So they are the characters there. Now, there's one building on Main Street that has absolutely no purpose whatsoever, and this is the only building on Main Street that has that. And it's right round. If you sort of you've walked down Main Street, you take a left, right round on the wall, you'll see Dr. Johnson's Pink Pills for Pale People. And in front of us, we have a store known as Kitty Hawk's Bicycle Shop. And Kitty Hawk's Bicycle Shop actually has never had any use for it whatsoever. It is just a fronted store. Now, why Kitty Hawk? Well, it appears, from what I've been looking at, that Disney did use a naval aircraft carrier during the filming of Lieutenant Robinson Crusoe, USN. And this naval aircraft carrier they used actually had exactly the same name. It had Kitty Hawk. They spent 5 days aboard the ship in July 1965. So the Kitty Hawk Bicycle Shop, you can actually go up and look into the window because the blinds are up slightly. But if you look inside, it really is. There's just a big black piece of wood behind it. There really is nothing there at all. Okay, we're turning round and we can see right in front of us the Discovery Arcade. To the right of that, the Tasker skating shoe sent to any part of the United States for $3. Manufactured by H&F H. Tasker, 991 and 993 Fulton Street. So obviously for something somewhere else. We're now standing in front of the George Eastman Photographic Studio, and the sign here says George Eastman Photographic Studio, photographic marvels for a new century. Now, this man here, he actually is George Eastman, who was the man who created the first camera, and it was introduced to the world in 1888. Now, the three decorated windows have no link to any Disney employees or workers, but the first window on the left reads portraits by M.A., portrait to share. Second window, weddings and graduations. So those windows are there really just as an advertisement rather than as anything else. So we're walking on along a little bit further. Obviously, Kodak have quite a big presence on the photographic studio. And we're now really walking onto the main part of Main Street. But just before we get there, we're going to stop at the Town Square Photography. We have a name up the top here on the building, 1885. We have surgical practical Dr. Jim Cora. Our operations will keep you in stitches. Now, James Jim Cora is awarded the profession of surgeon. Now, like Dick Nunes, Cora joined Disney as a simple cast member in 1957. He then climbed the steps of the company through meetings with Walt Disney in Disneyland and was appointed to the head of the Disney University, training service employees at Disneyland as Disney's parks. He then joined the leadership of Walt Disney Attractions with the task of improving operation procedures at both Disneyland and the Magic Kingdom, and was appointed Chief Operating Officer during the construction of Tokyo Disneyland, as well as Vice President of the Japanese subsidiary of the Walt Disney Company until the opening of the park. In 1985, he was associated with the project of Euro Disneyland, and then in 1985, he was active management at the park. In 1995, he was appointed President of Walt Disney International, responsible for the development of Tokyo Disney Sea. We're gonna make our way now around the corner onto the main part of Main Street itself. Once again, I think I'm just about to be run over by a Main Street bus, so I'm just going to move myself out of the way. But as we get to the actual corner, as we're just about to turn onto Main Street, again, there's another little sort of plaque built into the floor with Elias Disney Contractor 1901. So again, another nod to Walt Disney's father down on the floor. Main Street number 14 bus just coming past us as we speak. And we're coming around the corner and we're getting to the Boardwalk Candy Company. Building is purple and green, and there is the date of 1888, and it's the Till You building up at the top. Now, the first sort of, I suppose it's almost like a tower-like building because it's quite thin. So the next part of the candy palace is lighter green, and it has three sets of elongated windows. The first window has the following written on it: Big Deal, General Supplies, Paul Moulet, Herb Shelley. If we don't have it, neither do you. Paul Mallet was a buyer for the Disney Company, and obviously if he didn't buy those things, then it's exactly right. We wouldn't have had those things. It's fairly safe to assume that Herb was also the same sort of person. Herb, again, there's very little we've found about him. Then we get to an interesting thought that actually Walt Disney and Roy Disney don't appear until this middle window. I thought it'd be we might have seen them before here, but they appear in this middle window here. It says, Two Brothers Incorporated, Dreams and Doers, If We Can Dream It, We Can Do It. Roy O. Disney and Walt E. Disney, founder and partners. Now, I think this window needs very, very little explanation. Yeah. Walt and his brother obviously founded and were partners in the original Disney Company way, way back when they even started the first Disney Studios. They created Disneyland together and then begun plans for Walt Disney World, and obviously Walt died at the time of it being created. And they are supposed to be this idea of, again, the opening credits to the show, and you're about to experience the closing credits as you leave at the end of the day. So it's that idea there. So we're moving down a little bit further. We get to it's a strange sort of building, and it has a little bit of a canopy, and it has a red bricked area, and this is the Disney Clothiers Company. The shop has a large green sign in front, and due to its size and this canopy, there again are no windows over the top, unfortunately. But we're going to move ourselves down that a little bit further. Okay, here it is. It reads, Town Square Taxidermy, Sam Hutchins, Claude Rains, If It's Stuffed, We Sell It. Now, Sam Hutchins was the director of merchandising for the opening of Euro Disney, along with Claude Rains, who was also a member of the Disney marketing team. And we're now at number 210 Main Street, which is the home of the Main Street Motors. Now, the store mostly sells adult clothing and is on the corner of Main Street and the market and Market Street, which we're going to explore in a second. An old gas pump stands outside the shop, giving it a feel of an old turn-of-the-century garage. Now, there are no windows at the top of the Main Street side of the building, but there are large wooden billboards advertising certain things. Nescafe, Rich and Satisfying, Visit the Coffee Grinder, which is for the building that's coming around in a second. But there is actually sort of like a 3D coffee cup on there. And if you watch really, really carefully, you can see that this coffee cup does actually occasionally let out steam. As we're about to turn around, we're about to sort of take a left turn round to Market Street itself. And there's another billboard on the corner of the Main Street Motors. And it is a Coca-Cola advertisement. It says, drink Coca-Cola, delicious and refreshing. The hit that saves the day. In bottles, 5 cents. We define them on that. If the bottles are 5 cents, they're charging much more. And front is again got a baseball player on it. Its hat has a C on the front, of course, then linking itself to Casey's, which is just round the corner on the other side. We have the Gibson Girls Ice Cream Parlour serving ice cream at 400 Main Street, which we come to a little bit further down the road. And they have got a Ben and Jerry sign on there, which actually, as much as that's a modern sign, it fits in quite nicely with exactly what's going on. So we're now in the alcove on the right, which is currently full of tables. This is Market Street. Now, having turned into Market Street, an elongated brick building is seen to us for Main Street Motors. It is also, that say, the side of Main Street Motors, but we have lots of other small buildings here as well. Now, the Main Street Motors sign here reads, "Drive into the 20th century. The safest, fastest and finest cars in America are at the Main Street Motors." Now, there's two windows with dark blue canopies just slightly further along that are decorated with this the following words. "The Third Eye Detective Agency, John Larson, Gerard Degons, I think his name is. Now, Gerard was the financial vice president at Disneyland Paris until 2000. And John Larson seems to be, he was like a film show director that has done some work within Epcot. But I was unable again to find a link for him within Disneyland Paris. And maybe he did something along the way and was obviously given that. Yeah, tribute to him. We're moving down here past Main Street Motors and we're coming past a little alcove. We've got another advert for Disney Clothiers. We've got the Main Street Marketplace entrance this time that takes us into the opposite side of the opposite arcade down here. We've also got some nice little features that, again, don't necessarily do a huge amount, but adds to the atmosphere. We have the Main Street Laundry, which is the Mr. Lucky Tailor Shop. It's Mahjong Parlour upstairs. I don't think we need to say any more about that one. So we're now coming past the arcade, and there's a small building here which in the summer sells things like drinks and pastries, things like that. But we do have Bueller's Boarding House. We're now stood in front of Bueller's Boarding House, which is 1221 Market Street. And the boarding house has several names on them of people who are obviously staying in the boarding house itself. In room number one, we've got W. Winfield, who we think is linked to a writer for the Walt Disney Studios. His son, Jess Winfield, worked for Disney until 2005. In room two, we have W.M. Bobbin. We're unsure as to this person. We think that he is somebody from Walt's childhood. In three, we have N. Bly, and this is a nod to Nellie Bly, who travelled around the world in 72 days, and maybe she was staying here on her travels. In room number four, we have H.M. Sanders. Now, creating imaginary experiences through artistic venues, K.C. Sanders was working within the Disney Fine Art and started as a young child and has grown with the Disney Company ever since. K.C. would visit the Disneyland resorts every year with his family while growing up in Ogden, Utah. He thrilled in the magic that the Walt Disney Imagineers created for him and millions around the world. Does H.M. also stand for Haunted Mansion? So, number five, then, we have A.P. Goddy. He is possibly the name of a comic novel writer, and Disney turned to his novel, The Reluctant Assassin, and turned it into a film called Never a Dull Moment in 1968. Now, room number six is vacant. Room number seven is Harmony Bob. Now, I believe this could be Bob Disney, and it could also be another Bob as well, which I'll come to in a second. But this Bob Disney is a man who was a singer-songwriter for barbershop quartets. But it could also be linked to Bob Disney becoming Robert Disney, which is Walt's uncle, who kept the peace during the time of Walt and Roy starting out in Hollywood. Number eight, we have J. Junkmeyer. The name brings up, again, very few results, but it seems that the name originates in Germany. It could actually be somebody related to Walt Disney's time at war in France, when he may have worked with others. R. Sherwood, M.D. Now, Walt Disney developed his love of drawing as a child with one of his neighbours, a retired doctor named Doc Sherwood, and he paid him to draw pictures, and he was one of the first people to pay him, along with another Sherwood, who also paid him, who was a hairdresser. So I think that's sort of a nod to those people way back. So we're going to sort of move away from that door, and we are moving around slightly. We can see now the coffee grinder in front of us. This is to the right of the boarding house, and above the coffee grinder window is the TNT Talent Agency. Regency. Again, no name associated, but you can hear the sounds of rehearsals going on if you listen really carefully. It's, when it is open, it opens and sells drinks and snacks. We come to the ice cream company next, which is here. Again, this only has one decorative window, which is to do with corsets, but it doesn't have anybody's name really related within Disney. It's just another nice window to have there. The windows, obviously, now we go past the Market House Deli, and this is going to take us back round to the main part of Main Street. Now, going round back to the main part of Main Street, the windows again become more prominent, and they include some famous figures from the world of Disney. The first on the deli reads, Nellie Bly Travel Agency, Rail, Land, Sea, Book Passage Around the World. The next is a double window. It reads, Doctor Office Robert Sherwood, MD, General Medicine and Surgery. This links, obviously, to the room taken up by R. Sherwood at Beulah's Boarding House. He's obviously living just round the corner. The final window reads, Business Office, Carol Woods Pacific, Fairweather Route, the biggest little railroad in the world, the Carol Woods Pacific. This was linked to Walt Disney having his love for trains, and he built a train in his back garden, and he called it the Carol Woods Pacific, so that links to that. The Nellie Bly, again, links to somebody else who was staying over at Beulah's Boarding House, somebody who travelled again around the world in 72 days. As we enter back onto Main Street, we again are seeing some more interesting-looking windows. We can see in front of us the building for Harrington's Porcelain. And above it, on the sort of the right-hand part of that, is the Main Street Gazette, which again has three windows attached to it. Here are the windows as follows. We demonstrate the highest regard for truth in advertising, honesty, Mark Ferry and Ron Colan. Now, Mark Ferry was Vice President of Marketing at Disneyland Paris's opening. Ron Colan was Senior Vice President of International Theatrical Productions at the Walt Disney Company. Now, the next window down reads, Main Street Gazette advertises welcome publicity experts at your service, Jean-Marie Gabou and Tom Elrod. Now, Jean-Marie was a Communications Vice President for Euro Disney, and Tom Elrod was President of Marketing and Entertainment for the Walt Disney Company. And the final one. The final window reads, Main Street Gazette, since 1867, we print the news before it happens. Marty Sklar and Tony Baxter. Now, these two names are probably very well known to those of you who may be listening over in the States or those of you who visit Walt Disney World. Now, Tony Baxter, I can say, and Marty Sklar are two of the most influential, I think, Imagineers. Both Imagineers played major roles in the development of the park. So, we're going past Harrington's Porcelains. Again, it has nice big window. Nothing written on that window, though. But we're now moving to the cable car bake shop. There are two windows above the red bricked bake shop. The first reads, Chastain, a design company of Glendale Budgeting and Scheduling. Now, the Chastain building was built at the Glendale site in California, and it was originally the home of the Walt Disney Imagineers, but it's now used by Pixar. They are said to be making Toy Story 3 there. Now, the second window has the following. Mrs. Twiddle's Secretarial Services. And again, this is just a name that's been created specifically for the park, but doesn't necessarily have anything at all related to it other than that there. We move along a little bit further, and we have some more windows above the bake shop. The Main Street School of Charm window can be seen above the cable car bake shop, and it reads the following. Main Street School of Charm, instructor Steve Llewellyn, Hani Verma, Malcolm Ross, will make your guests feel like magic. Now, Steve Llewellyn earned increasingly important roles as Vice President in charge of operations for Disney's International Theme Park Division. Hani Verma was part of the operations team, and Malcolm Ross was a Vice President of Euro Disney. Now, the next window along, this is the final window which gives a nod to people. It says the following. Society of Arts Craftsmen Ron Esposito, Skip Lang and John Olsen will make your molehill into a mountain. Now, Ron Esposito was the Imagineer in charge of colour theming. He obviously was the man who obviously had a lot to do with creating the colour for Thunderbolt Mountain, things like that. Skip Lang was a ride, show and attraction design, and John Olsen made scale models for the park. So the three people, obviously it says we can make a molehill into a mountain. Links nicely to Thunderbolt Mountain, to Space Mountain, to all of those things. So we're walking down now Main Street. We're really coming against the point where it all opens out. If we turn ourselves to the right, We're coming down past Victoria's Home Style Restaurant. Now, you can see ahead of me now the Main Street Tips Board, which is there, and the Plaza Gardens, which is down here, is on the right. Now, if we walk through the gardens, which we're going to do in a second, of outside the Plaza Restaurant, this has a specific area and a specific name. It is known as Edison Avenue. Now, Edison Avenue obviously links to Charles Edison. Electric lights are now here, so it all links in really nicely. But it actually starts off from Edison Street, or Edison Square, sorry, which was originally going to be built in Disneyland's Main Street. Edison Square was going to be sort of an offshoot of Disneyland's Main Street that was never built. So really they took the name of Edison Square, turned it into Edison Avenue, and turned it into a street here through Disneyland Paris's Main Street. But there we go, that is your tour of the right-hand side of Main Street here in Disneyland Paris. Hopefully you've learned a little bit more. Hopefully you might decide to bring these with you to the park and explore them a bit more. That's pretty much it for this edition of the podcast. Once again, I'd like to thank you all for joining us. We'd also like to thank our sponsors, Attraction Tickets Direct and Complete Orlando. You can find them at attraction-tickets-direct.co.uk and completeorlando.co.uk. Thanks once again to Juz and Craig for joining me. And a huge, huge thank you to Lee Cockerell for coming onto the show and giving us some insight about his life and his work with Disney. You can find out more about him by visiting www.leecockerell.com. Also, make sure to check out the Disney Brit Legacy Award Hall of Fame. You can find that at www.disneybrit.com/Hall of Fame. And there you'll find out lots more information about Lee Cockerell. Make sure to email us your questions, comments and suggestions. You can do that at disneybrit@hotmail.com. And try and make sure, please, see if you can give us a ring on our voicemail numbers in the park, in the US, in the UK. Our UK number 0121 288 2858 and US number 407 545 7980. Make sure to check out our website at disneybrit.com and check out our Facebook page and our Disney Brit fan page. You can also friend up myself, Juz and Craig over there. But please leave us a review on iTunes and make sure, you know, people know what you think of the show. Thanks to those people who have donated to the show. Really is greatly appreciated. And remember, you can still sign up for Mouse Meets at www.disneybrit.com/mousemeets.asp. Check out our sister podcast at Eye on Orlando. You can also find that on iTunes. But also make sure to download the full audio tour that is now available as a separate podcast that's to download this week. So make sure you do listen to that, download that, take that to the park with you when you go to Disneyland Paris and find out a little bit more about Main Street as you tour it. The next show will be on Wednesday, the 2nd of September. So until then, we'll see you.